KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Go over the fiscal cliff, but I think he's willing to take that chance if need be. Remember, it's not really a cliff. The increase in taxes and the decrease in spending will be parceled out a little bit at a time. So if everyone's taxes were to go up on January 1st, and then they could easily then go back and reduce people's taxes again on January 2nd or January 15th or February 1st. It's not as the consequences are not nearly so dire as they were when he was staring at a possible default.
Really?
That's right.
But didn't the CBO just say?
The CBO said if you go over the cliff, if you go over the cliff and never do anything about it, it could push the country back into a recession. But it's not as if we go over the cliff on January 1, we're guaranteed to have a recession. They could go over the cliff on January 1, they could make a deal on January 2, recession averted, problem solved.
I like to think of it more as a dune.
Tamara, a cliff dune.
Yes, not quite the cliff, but more of a dune. Many of the layoffs that would happen wouldn't happen immediately. Basically, there is potentially time to fix this, though I would say that the discussion now is more about how they can come up with some sort of a framework of a deal and then kick the can down the road 3 or 6 months.
By the way, the CBO actually said that, if they go over the fiscal cliff, it would send us into a recession next year, and we'd come out of the recession stronger and healthier and with a deficit problem largely resolved.
Though that said, no one is calling for that.
All right, so we are waiting for President Obama to come out any moment now in the East Wing of the White House. Ron Elving, you think then that Mr. Obama might have an upper hand here that he didn't have a year ago?
The one thing I think he does have is that the Republicans have lost the prospect of getting a president of their own for another 4 years. For months, they've been able to think, gee, if we could just get to the winter, just get through that election, get Mitt Romney elected, then we'll have a guy we can work with more easily. Maybe we'll even get control of the Senate. And then we'd really be in the catbird seat, and we could set our own fiscal policy. And we could change things quite radically if we want to. And that just was such a gorgeous prospect for them. Well, it mesmerized them, and it made it much more difficult for them to come to the table.
Not only did they not get their own president, but they lost seats in the House of Representatives, and they lost seats in the Democratic-controlled Senate. So the Democrats are in a stronger position now, certainly, than they were a year and a half ago.
But, Tamara, Keith, is that the view from Capitol Hill, from the House, where you are now?
Well, certainly John Boehner believes that he has a mandate just as much as the president has a mandate because, well, he's still the speaker and they're still in control.
He must be listening to Mitt Romney's pollster.
Well,
oof.
I mean, because the exit polls were very clear. I mean, a majority of Americans believe that we should see higher taxes on the wealthy. Even a not inconsiderable fraction of Mitt Romney's supporters believe we should see higher taxes on the wealthy. The Democrats talked about raising taxes on the wealthy throughout the campaign. If they weren't talking about it, the Republicans were reminding people that if Barack Obama was reelected, we'd see higher taxes on the wealthy. The American people have spoken on that subject. We're going to see higher taxes on the wealthy.
All right. And we have President Obama now approaching the podium in the East Wing of the White House.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Everybody, please have a seat. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Now that those of us on the campaign trail have had a chance to get a little sleep, it's time to get back to work. And there is plenty of work to do. As I said on Tuesday night, the American people voted for action, not politics as usual. You elected us to focus on your jobs, not ours. And in that spirit, I've invited leaders of both parties to the White House next week so we can start to build consensus around the challenges that we can only solve together. And I also intend to bring in business and labor and civic leaders from all across the country here to Washington to get their ideas and input as well. You know, at a time when our economy is still recovering from the Great Recession, our top priority has to be jobs and growth. That's the focus of the plan that I talked about during the campaign. It's a plan to reward small businesses and manufacturers that create jobs here, not overseas. It's a plan to give people the chance to get the education and training that businesses are looking for right now. It's a plan to make sure this country is a global leader in research and technology and clean energy, which will attract new companies and high-wage jobs to America. It's a plan to put folks back to work, including our veterans, rebuilding our roads and our bridges and other infrastructure. And it's a plan to reduce our deficit in a balanced and responsible way. Now, our work is made that much more urgent because at the end of this year, we face a series of deadlines that require us to make major decisions about how to pay our deficit down. Decisions that will have a huge impact on the economy and the middle class, both now and in the future. Last year, I worked with Democrats and Republicans to cut $1 trillion worth of spending that we just couldn't afford. I intend to work with both parties to do more, and that includes making reforms that will bring down the cost of health care so we can strengthen programs like Medicaid and Medicare for the long haul. But, as I've said before, we can't just cut our way to prosperity. If we're serious about reducing the deficit, we have to combine spending cuts with revenue. And that means asking the wealthiest Americans to pay a little more in taxes. That's how we did it. That's how we did it in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president. That's how we can reduce the deficit while still making the investments we need to build a strong middle class and a strong economy. That's the only way we can still afford to train our workers or help our kids pay for college or make sure that good jobs in clean energy or high-tech manufacturing don't end up in countries like China. Now, already I've put forward a detailed plan that allows us to make these investments while reducing our deficit by $4 trillion over the next decade. I want to be clear, I'm not wedded to every detail of my plan. I'm open to compromise. I'm open to new ideas. I'm committed to solving our fiscal challenges. But I refuse to accept any approach that isn't balanced. I am not going to ask students and seniors and middle-class families to pay down the entire deficit while people like me making over $250,000 aren't asked to pay a dime more in taxes. I'm not going to do that. And I just want to point out, this was a central question during the election. It was debated over and over again. And on Tuesday night, we found out that the majority of Americans agree with my approach. And that includes Democrats, independents, and a lot of Republicans across the country, as well as independent economists and budget experts. That's how you reduce the deficit, with a balanced approach. So our job now is to get a majority in Congress to reflect the will of the American people. And I believe we can get that majority. I was encouraged to hear Speaker Boehner agree that tax revenue has to be part of this equation. So I look forward to hearing his ideas when I see him next week. And let me make one final point that every American needs to hear. Right now, if Congress fails to come to an agreement on an overall deficit reduction package by the end of the year, everybody's taxes will automatically go up on January 1st. Everybody's, including the 98% of Americans who make less than $250,000 a year. And that makes no sense. It would be bad for the economy and would hit families that are already struggling to make ends meet. Now, fortunately, we shouldn't need long negotiations or drama to solve that part of the problem. While there may be disagreement in Congress over whether or not to raise taxes on folks making over $250,000 a year, nobody, not Republicans, not Democrats, want taxes to go up for folks making under $250,000 a year. So let's not wait. Even as we're negotiating a broader deficit reduction package, let's extend the middle class tax cuts right now. Let's do that right now. That one step would give millions of families, 98% of Americans, and 97% of small businesses, the certainty that they need going into the new year. It would immediately take a huge chunk of the economic uncertainty off the table, and that'll lead to new jobs and faster growth. Business will know that consumers, they're not going to see a big tax increase. They'll know that most small businesses won't see a tax increase. And so a lot of the uncertainty that you're reading about, that will be removed. In fact, the Senate has already passed a bill doing exactly this. So all we need is action from the House. And I've got the pen ready to sign the bill right away. I'm ready to do it. You know, the American people understand that we're going to have differences and disagreements in the months to come. They get that. But on Tuesday, they said loud and clear that they won't tolerate dysfunction. They won't tolerate politicians who view compromise as a dirty word. Not when so many Americans are still out of work. Not when so many families and small business owners are still struggling to pay the bills. What the American people are looking for is cooperation. They're looking for consensus. They're looking for common sense. Most of all, they want action. I intend to deliver for them in my second term, and I expect to find willing partners in both parties to make that happen. So let's get to work. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
President Barack Obama speaking at the White House. We'll review the news of the week right now.
Just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory.
I know, but you know how it goes when we vote by mail. It takes a little bit longer, but this year it will be worth the wait.
I believe tonight our state has taken another step forward, and we have elected a forward-looking governor.
We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try.
President Obama on election night and other voices of that campaign, and then President Obama today. As we review the news of this day and this week, Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Good to see you, madam.
Good morning. And the madam thing, I don't know.
Okay. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor for the Everett Herald. I was going to say monsieur, but I will not now.
French makes it sound better sometimes.
It does. Yeah. Madame, I should have said.
French makes it sound un-American.
Yes, well. Left Coast. Eli Sanders is a journalist, associate editor at The Stranger, and, Left Coast.
Yes. Nice to be here.
C.R. Douglas is a political analyst for Q13 Fox News and Left Coast. I don't know what that means. But all right, so I was watching this, and I said, is Obama negotiating with himself again? And you all looked at me and said, no, he's not. So didn't he just say, look, let's get the business of the uncertainty out of the way, and whether we raise taxes on the wealthy, well, we can negotiate that.
That's not what I heard.
What did you hear?
Well, I heard him just say the R word, the revenue idea, because the election's over. It's time to start kind of framing things with Congress. And he said that John Boehner said that he would consider tax increases, but what Boehner then said was we may disagree about this topic. You know, he said we'll consider it, but we may disagree about this topic, also known as we do disagree.
I thought he said revenues anyways.
He did. He used the R word, but revenue. But he's just setting the stage here. He's taking command. He had a night's sleep. You kind of mentioned that.
He had a night's sleep.
And he's ready to go, you know. So that's what that is.
All right, what did you hear, Eli?
Well, I heard him say, let's not raise taxes on the middle class. And almost, you know, kind of trying to squeeze Congress on that point. Trying to catch Republicans in their own rhetoric, which is that they don't want tax increases. So he's saying, fine, no tax increases for people under $250,000. And then he's saying it's non-negotiable. He wants a balanced approach which means you're going to have to raise revenue, which means you're going to have to raise it probably from people making over $250,000. So I don't see a negotiation with himself there. I see actually a pretty hard line.
Do you see a hard line too?
I do hear a hard line. I hear a president who is claiming a pretty clear mandate, a mandate that he wants a balanced approach to really the biggest problem that faces us, which is this fiscal cliff and you know, spending, the deficit and taxes and all the rest. He does say he's open to compromise, but as Eli says, he is going to, and I think this is his words, refuse to accept any approach that isn't balanced. He did take a hard line in the campaign about the sort of top 1% paying more, their fair share, you know, all kind of language in that respect.
It sounded like it was 2% in there with his 98%. But, yeah.
But here's a president that is saying that is one of the major reasons I was elected. It was a big sort of theme between the two. And, you know, I think we're sort of up against a clash here because Speaker Boehner, who came out the other day, is claiming a mandate too. I mean, after all, the Republicans won the House again, and their line in the sand is no increase in tax rates. Now, I think there's a little bit of room here for some maneuvering because revenue can be increased without increasing tax rates. I mean, one thing that perhaps could happen here is you let all the Bush tax cuts get extended, even on the top 1% and 2%, but you heavily reduce deductions that would really hit the 1%, the 2%. So you would get more out of that, you know, class. You would increase revenue. They would be paying more of their fair share. I think you could probably sort of spin it that way. But Republicans could say, hey, we didn't increase rates. They sort of stayed the same. I feel like that's where some compromise could be on this. But they are both drawing a line in the sand.
That is a really tough thing to negotiate in 6 weeks. Get rid of deductions and rates. You think they can do that? I just don't.
Yes.
What did you do? What did you hear?
Yeah, I definitely agree that, I mean, it's sort of a throwing down the gauntlet, and that's why there's going to be such an onus on this Congress to really kind of show whether or not they're willing to deal.
But there is something beautiful about a lame duck Congress that we found in the past, that actually that's one of the times of the year that things actually get done.
Right.
Some
right.
people are leaving. They're certainly not running for office for this minute. And so they do have some wiggle room here. You do have to, if you use the word compromise, and this is why I was intrigued by what you said, CR, you do have to find a way for the folks who have to come your way to save face. So if you hold it on the rates and go after the loopholes, that is a way to give everybody something. And you do have to do that even when you're talking compromise.
Yeah.
And I think when he also mentions compromise, he says, I'm open to compromise. It sounds like he is absolutely not open to compromise on this top, you know, 1% and 2% pay more. But I hear that as saying, listen, I'm willing to sort of deal on entitlements. I'm willing to sort of deal on spending. And he was on the verge of sort of making that deal a year and a half ago with John Boehner. So his compromise, I think, is in that side of it. And that's a signal to, it seems to me, Republicans, who after all will sort of control the other side of this negotiation, that, hey, you got to give me on some revenue here if I give you entitlement.
But he's also signaling that he's going to negotiate from the position of a sense that the people are on his side. I mean, he made a really clear point. The people voted for action. They voted for me. They voted for my view of how to handle this. So I think that's the position, one of the positions of strength that he's going to negotiate from.
I like Joni's point about the productivity of lame duck sessions because, I mean, there are things like Alaska National Interest Lands and Conservation Act in 1980 where, I mean, literally knowing the next guy is coming in and it was a lame duck session, you're able to, I mean, it's a cudgel. And there, again, the pressure couldn't be higher.
They need cudgels.
They do.
Let me come back to that question of compromise in a minute because I want to ask about claiming the mandate here. And is it legitimate, and since you said it first, CR, please defend. Is it legitimate for the House Republicans to claim a mandate when, you know, that's a lot of individual races, not one big decision of an electorate?
I think if you look at this election, obviously the House Republicans retained power, lost a couple seats, but retained power. But you know, the national election went for Obama. Sort of Romneyism did not win. And if Romney stood for sort of
and certainly not Romnesia. Well,
you know, two things. The sort of repeal of Obamacare seemed to me one of the, you know, highest sort
of day one
tenets of Romneyism, and also sort of not increasing taxes on the wealthy. That was sort of a big, big part of Romneyism. I think that lost. So I think Republicans in the House, I mean, John Boehner claimed a mandate, but it seems like in this negotiation, the president will have the upper hand. He will have just won, you know, not just the Electoral College, but the popular vote. And I think Republicans are going to have to move more than the president will in this negotiation, given how this election turned out.
And they're going to have to move toward the middle class. I mean, the Democrats won by focusing on the middle class. So if the Republicans continue to be seen as the party of, you know, Romney's percentage of the population, that's not good for them. And they can see that, hopefully.
Do they have a mandate, House Republicans?
No. I don't see how that's a mandate.
Well, this is the battle for the mandate, and that's why Obama in that speech mentioned how much the voters picked him about four times, and that was only about, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes there. Voters picked him. They want us. They like our
one of the ways also, sorry, that you can see that they don't have a mandate is that Boehner came out on day one and said Obamacare is the law of the land. If they had a mandate for their positions, they'd still be clinging to the idea of repealing it.
Were you going to say something else, Sierra?
Well, he feels like he backtracked on that a couple days later, too. So I think Boehner is still in a really tricky position, you know, with a you know, still a majority in that House. And they're not going to give up lightly.
Not when they throw in a debt ceiling as part of the negotiation right off the bat, right. Too.
Well, one of the funniest things to me about John Boehner is when he lost – this is a guy who tears up at sort of very, you know, at anything, a drop of a hat. But when he lost, he didn't tear up. He sort of tears up when he's happy or something. So I don't know how to read that, but it's important to note that the crying machine was not in evidence there.
What does compromise look like if the president gets, let's say the president gets what he just asked for, and in the next 2 weeks they decide to to not raise taxes on the middle class, to keep those taxes from going up. What does compromise look like after that?
Well, it has some mix of spending and spending cuts and revenue that they'd been talking about, that ratio, even back going down back to the debates and the Republican primary battle. What is a number? Is there, you know, whatever ratio, some ratio is what they're speaking of.
You agree with that? But you think that if he gets them to agree, which he's not going to get, but let's say he gets them to agree in the next 2 weeks, okay? If they give up on the if they pass no middle class tax cuts, what's their bargaining position after that point?
Exactly. That's why I saw this as a very hard opening gambit. I mean, he's got them in a tough position. They can be seen as against the middle class by trying to hold on to their one bargaining chip, or they have to give up their bargaining chip. I think it's a shrewd opening gambit.
I see. Interesting. All right. Well, we already touched on this, but overall, what happened in this election, Johnny?
Well, what happened is the state of Washington sort of proved that it's left of California here on a couple of issues. December 6th is the date. Marriages can begin. Same-sex marriages can begin. You can light up on December 6th, and I know you're all waiting till December 6th.
Do it in the privacy of your home.
Do such a thing. You know, these were some really interesting decisions nationwide, and if you watch the national coverage, John Stewart had some stuff on this last night, how many bad puns were surrendered in the name of describing our pot vote, mostly. These anchors were just going, oh, my gosh, the things that were said. But it did create this sort of image, if you put the two together, because they spoke of the gay marriage, which hit three states, and the marijuana, which hit two. The common denominator in both of those was the state of Washington. It was like, wow, that's a really interesting state. So all of that was, you know, groundbreaking, historic.
Let's stick with gay marriage for a minute. Where does gay marriage go from here? Where does the fight over this issue and broader issues go from here, do you think?
It's DOMA, isn't it? They're going to have to kind of attack it on the federal level. And then the Supreme Court will be taking it up. What is it? Well, next
it will decide in November whether it's taken.
Whether it's taken up the DOMA issue. Yeah.
Well, the supporters of same-sex marriage now have a new tool in their arsenal. This fight started by going to courts. That's how they won in Iowa. That's how they won in Massachusetts. Then it went to state legislatures. That's how they won in New York. That's how they won originally here in Washington State.
And Maryland.
And now for the first time, this new tool is plebiscites, you know, sort of a vote of the people, which their record before Tuesday was 0-32. They won in four states on Tuesday. So they are very buoyed by this. So they're going to continue the court fight. They're going to continue to work in state legislatures. Absolutely. But this is a route they did not have before. And I would be surprised if you don't see, you know, a sort of attempt again at California, you know, and some of these other states to actually do votes of the people and sort of, you know, get more states. There are now nine.
Have you looked at how it was broken, how the vote went in other states in terms of percentages?
I didn't. I haven't looked.
Did anybody look at that?
Just about mid. It was low to mid 50s in both in
the. About comparable to ours.
Yeah, about comparable. It was. I mean, there was a moment, a couple of moments during election night where Maine and Maryland, Maine especially, I think was iffy.
So what does that tell you, Eli? What does that tell you about? I mean, you looked at our state. You saw how split it was, though majority.
It tells me that we've reached a cultural tipping point. I mean, it's really amazing. I personally did not expect to see for a very long time majorities support equal rights for gays and lesbians. That was not something I expected. So it tells me we've reached a really wonderful and new moment in the culture. I mean, it's astounding to me.
And I think you see, and you're increasingly seeing, that Republicans are coming on board this. I mean, it is more bipartisan than it certainly ever has been. And they're coming at it through freedom, through sort of take the government out of people's lives. So that's where you get a sort of a Reagan Dunn, a Dan Evans, you know. So there's a comfortable spot and a philosophy, you know, ideologically coherent way for a conservative to come to this, and more are. And that's just creating majorities for this.
One of the things and I am weird in this way, that I like to go to the Secretary of State's website and look at the maps, the county by county numbers on ballot measures and other races. What was fascinating to me was the difference between the map on saying yes to marijuana and the map on saying yes to gay marriage. So the gay marriage map, if you look at it, yes came from very few populous counties. And no, doing no business east of the mountains, which, you know, happens around here. But the pot map actually spread from the Puget Sound region across, and I'm just guessing.
North.
Here, northern Washington, northern and into north central Washington, which must be pot growing country, was all I could conclude.
Well, and where a lot of the BC bud comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be people who have economic interests and legalizing.
And even though I talk about sort of the crossover and the sort of move to bipartisan sort of majority with same-sex marriage, I think with pot, you saw that even more. I mean, some of the most visible defenders of pot, certainly if you look at the commercials, were John McKay, a former Republican U.S. attorney, the guy who used to be the former, you know, FBI guy locally. I mean, this was a conservative-led, in a lot of ways, initiative. And many people voted for this, not because they're pot users, even care about pot. They love the revenue of it. You know, I mean, there was a sort of conservative, you know, element to this. And that's why I think you saw.
Well, it was also sort of where do you want your law enforcement dollar to be spent? And do you want people to go to jail for carrying, you know, small amounts of pot?
Yeah. And that's something that really resonated in places like Snohomish County. Right.
That revenue figure, by the way, is $1.9 billion potentially over the first 5 years, which our cash-strapped state certainly could use.
Right, they'll eat it up in 2 seconds. They really will. There's a line right now formed outside the doors of the state capitol for different groups that want that money.
Let me stick with the question of the Republican Party, though, and this idea of I mean, how far do you want to go with that? A turning away from the social issues? Is that what happened here? Because the debate over same-sex marriage, yes, but it was also you're going to let the opponents You're going to have fourth graders learning about sex in schools. You're going to have a destruction of the definition. I mean, it was very much a campaign about social issues. So where does that leave the sort of the notion of the Republican Party looking at freedom as a way to argue this?
Well, I think kind of one thing I wanted to say about that is that I believe that gay marriage is what's helping Jay Inslee. In fact, I think he probably can credit what is likely to be a win with the sort of same-sex marriage surge that helped him.
As opposed to pot.
As I think pot helped.
He's neutral.
I know.
Pot helped
but
him
pot,
too.
You think pot helped him?
Yeah. Pot helps him too. Just
could have helped him more if he had endorsed 502, I think.
But I think, I mean, we'll never know this, but if you talk about sort of conservatism and social issues, I mean, Rob McKenna, you know, reasonably moderate. I mean, this is not a cultural crusader, but he was definitely, you know, he's definitely against same-sex marriage. He's pro-life, sort of personally finesses it a little bit when you talk about sort of different policies. But it would be interesting what the outcome would have been in King County. Counterfactual, you never know this. If Rob McKenna actually supported same-sex marriage, if Rob McKenna was sort of a Reagan Dunn or a Dan Evans on that issue, it is social issues are still huge in a place like King County, you know.
Well, also in the first congressional district,
right.
if they hold candidate school after this election, one of the first classes should be, will be, might be, do not candidates speak of rape and abortion when you're running for office, because no matter what you say, you're going to get into trouble, which is kind of what happened to John Koster on a lesser amount than two other races that were decisive on.
And you're equating that with social issues agenda.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. He was almost a caricature, I think, of the more kind of what traditional social movement, or movement conservative. And it kind of bled out to people like Rob McKenna, who is something of a moderate, but with Koster kind of being kind of a caricature.
Sorry. I mean, as much as we talk about this as a blue state, it certainly sort of is on these social issues, you know, these most recent initiatives give compelling evidence that I still think this is a sort of moderate fiscal state. I mean, look at how well Iman does.
Yeah, he's Iman, still doing
Iman,
well.
You know, almost two-thirds. Those two advisory ballots about, do you want to close the banking loophole and do you allow a little higher tax on petroleum? Those were resoundingly defeated. So Republicans, I think, have plenty of traction on sort of fiscal issues, you know, spending issues, but there is a disconnect with Washington, because I think Washington, there's sort of a threshold on social issues that if you sort of don't get over that, especially in King County, you're not going to sort of get any traction on your fiscal moderatism.
Yeah, the ship has sailed on those issues. I mean, to come back to your point, that Washington is now more liberal than Canada, more liberal than Amsterdam. I mean, this is where Republicans are living. It's true. It sounds bizarre, but it's true. We have more liberal marijuana policy than Amsterdam. We have more liberal same-sex marriage policy than Canada. So and marijuana policy.
I believe Whamsterdam has already been trademarked.
I mean, but so what CR is saying is true, and the Republicans just need to. I mean, you know, they don't normally take advice from the stranger, but if they want
some, oh, everybody does. Come on.
They need to just completely let go of their social issues nonsense. It's not going anywhere for them. This election has shown them that. And yeah, if they have anywhere left to argue, it would be on fiscal issues, because it's true. We are socially more liberal than Amsterdam or Canada, but fiscally, we are still pretty conservative.
I mean, neither candidate was willing to say revenue increase, you know, and that, you know, no one was forcing them to, you know, the public doesn't want tax increases.
They were trying to force each other to do that the whole time. But let's not forget women voters. They fought like crazy over women voters the whole time. There were women's voices on the commercials. There were women talking in one TV ad back to another, you know, about whether Rob McKenna was this or that. And women are 53% of the electorate in this state. And I'll tell you something, one thought I had about this had to do with Rob McKenna's activism on the health care lawsuit. And I don't know the answer, but I just wonder how much that was an impact.
Well, let's come back to that. Women voters and Latinos, as we look at this race, we're reviewing the news of the week. This is Weekday.
We have sunny skies in Seattle, 44 degrees right now in the University District, working towards a high of 46 today. Forecast says it's going to be partly sunny all day. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight and cold. Tonight's low near 33. Sunny and cold tomorrow, the high in the mid-40s. Then on Sunday, it's going to be cloudy with a chance of showers and a little bit warmer, the high in the upper 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
You're invited to The Dinner Party, Public Radio's new culture show.
This week, Monty Python's Eric Idle tells us how to navigate life.
Don't be polite to people who are boring you.
Words to live by. Plus, writer John Ronson plays sidekick to a real-life superhero.
He sort of has a power. Intense, very stupid bravery.
I'm Rico Galliano.
And I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. Join us this weekend for The Dinner Party.
And that comes your way tomorrow at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, dedicated to providing service for traveling families, including special meals, kids' kits full of surprises, and hundreds of on-demand entertainment options for young flyers. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
We're reviewing the news of this past week, election week, with C.R. Douglas, with Peter Jackson, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter. I want to come back to that question of women and Hispanics.
And younger voters.
But let's do it through the lens of the DelBene-Koster race. Because I had thought that initially this was supposed to be an evenly split district.
Yes.
But that Koster, better known, had run in that area before. I thought he was considered the favorite for a long time.
There's a couple of points here. One of them has very much to do with money. He was outspent considerably. Susan DelBene saved her ads for the very last couple weeks. The ads portrayed Koster as being this guy who's so dangerous, you're jumping off a cliff, you're doing reckless things.
And the rope breaks.
And then the rope breaks. But, you know, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee identified Koster a few weeks ago as one of the young guns. That means somebody they're going to get behind. And then from what I understand, they didn't put the money with it. They just did the announcement. And so he was outspent so much that he wasn't on network TV. He was on cable. Well, that's an advantage to the other candidate. The folks who drew that district said it was pretty evenly split, something like 49.3% Democrat. Why I remember that number, I can't explain. But but so he simply was outspent. There was a sort of... You know, don't talk badly about rape and abortion and don't offend women voters. He got caught up in some of that.
And you were saying also.
Well, I do think the National Party kind of left him hanging there. They didn't come in for him, and it was tough to compete with her money. You know, she was a pretty moderate voice in a district that's sort of 50-50. Then you get the blue wave that kind of ran across Washington on Tuesday, and you kind of see a sort of victory for the Democrat. It sort of is a divided district, and certainly the redistricting commission sort of had, you know, Slay Gorton had sort of arguments for why it was going to trend red, Tim Cease about why it was going to trend blue. But one thing is, it did go for Obama in 2008. So the sort of Democrat
it was
argument
a different district though that went for.
Yeah. Well, no, if they did the science on what the new boundaries would have looked like. So they're sort of it did trend bluer if you took those boundaries in a presidential year. So I think there was a bit of a headwind against Koster, even though it was drawn that way because it was a presidential year.
Well, it's going to be interesting. Kind of test of DelBene's mettle as well, because not only does she have to kind of maintain her moderate reputation, but she could be sworn in as soon as
she will be sworn in on Tuesday. They already announced that. The Secretary of State wrote
so
a letter.
So she'll have to take a vote on the fiscal cliff.
On the fiscal cliff.
And after so all those advertisements about
it. Right.
Because she goes back early, she gets better office space than some of her fellow freshmen.
She will be the highest... the highest the freshman with the highest seniority.
Yeah.
Something.
So they're separated by about 20,000 votes right now, according to the Secretary of State's page. So it's not even quite 20,000. The other factor. So you think women were a factor?
Totally.
You think
totally.
The social issues were a factor for him as well.
Yes. If this race had been run maybe more on the economy, he would have had a better chance. I'm pretty sure that's true. But it kept, you know, sort of there was a national phenomenon of social issues, and then there was an echo here in Washington of that.
I think his rape comments were just terrible self-inflicted wound toward the end.
So the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement put out their study yesterday. 22 to 23 million young Americans, so that's up to 29, 49% voted in Tuesday's election. And in Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, if Romney had won half the youth vote or if young voters had stayed home altogether, he would have won those key battleground states. They were 19% of the voters in yesterday's election, and President Obama won them 60 to 37%.
I think they were 18% in 2008, and they broke a little higher, 66% for Obama. But they're a factor. You know, everyone bemoans the fact that the younger voters, oh, they'll stay home, they're not engaged, they're not excited. They participated.
And we heard him mention college students in that address just now, that he's not going to balance the budget on the backs of college students who are already dealing with huge student loan problems and, you know, the unemployment rate.
I think the biggest single factor sort of demographically was the Latino vote. I mean, George Bush won 44% of the Latino vote in 2004. Mitt Romney will win, when it's all said and done, about 27%. So it is a decreasing share of a demographic that's growing. So it's sort of a electoral cliff, if you will, for Republicans. And that killed them in places like Colorado, like Nevada, like Florida. I mean, you have people since the election, Republicans, strong Republicans, Sean Hannity, Charles Krauthammer. I mean, all these guys are saying that immigration now has to be dealt with.
Yeah, they had a kind of Jesus moment yesterday, didn't they?
And they did. And I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, the Republican Party needs to sort of get with immigration reform. They have tried in the past. It's absolutely conceivable that they can do that and start gaining back some of that Latino vote.
Well, so go ahead.
But the vice that they're in is at the same time they may alienate their hardcore anti-immigrant, you know, base.
Because you have to look at the white vote in that question too, right?
Right. But the challenge will be, right, that's absolutely the challenge. But they're sort of doomed if they don't. So what they need to do is get, you know, a Susana Martina, you know, some of their Latino stars, a Marco Rubio. I mean, sort of these people need to be the voices of this move to really help the sort of conservative base that's going to resist this and that has in the past to bring them along to move them on this issue.
And that's kind of a lot of the analysis leading up to and after the election talked about the changing demographics of America and how the Republican Party, and this is why they were doing the hand-wringing, what will become of us if we can't adapt and talk to this group of people? Rachel Maddow, who's obviously partisan, but she had this tweet this morning that said there just aren't enough old white guys for the Republicans to kind of keep going. They have to branch out to other groups.
Well, and they saw it coming, too. I mean, remember John Judis, I think, wrote the book on the emerging Democratic majority years ago, that if you just look at the numbers, it's smart politics to start talking about those issues that will resonate with Latino population.
And it's karmic justice in a way that Republicans who got so much mileage out of pandering to the, you know, racist, anti-immigrant, you know, old, white, and resentful wing of their party for quite a long time are now going to have to do exactly what CR says, find a way to bring that constituency, which they can't just ignore, along into a more tolerant America.
And
I just add one that is somewhat changing this, but saying message in this campaign beat money. There was so much money spent, and some of it, you know, I don't know how these investors are going to feel, those who put down the money for some of the Republican candidates are going to feel. But a lot of money was spent to kind of pretty up some candidates, and it didn't work because the message was more powerful than the dollar.
And the solution has been out there. I mean, people like McCain, people like Lindsey Graham. I mean, the message is, and it resonates for both sides, is, you know, kind of strengthen the border, you know, so that's not kind of as porous as it's been, and then create a path to citizenship. I mean, this has been agreed to by both sides in the past, and I think they will get back to this. And even John Boehner said, we've got to deal with this problem. It is time to have immigration reform be sort of front and center in the next Congress.
When we saw the rise of the Tea Party initially, before it became, you know, turfed, they talked about, we're just going to be about the economy. We're not about social issues. They couldn't keep that promise, though.
Because they couldn't control the members of the Tea Party who were speaking in certain ways.
So this takes us back to that question of all the social issues that you were talking about. I mean, where does that leave a Republican Party if they're not running on anti-abortion and all the other social issues they're fighting about?
Here's the deal on that. They were supposedly not running on that. They were running on
it lingers under their
fiscal
look
and
at their
economic
platform,
issues.
Et
but then they have these rogue members of the Tea Party who go out and say things
that's
that,
not entirely rogue if they have it on their platform.
And if their that's own true. Elected representatives are saying these things, you know, it's
true.
The
true.
So-called rape caucus
but you're
that
not
we
supposed
heard so much
to,
from.
I mean, if they didn't read the memo, it says don't emphasize that. I'm pretty sure that's what it says. You know, don't make that make this campaign about economic possibilities for women and Latino and younger. That was more the sort of the focus. But then some people went off message.
But you all are saying this is, we won't see a backlash. We won't see a return to this in 2 years. We've moved beyond these social issues, and the Republican Party now has to catch up. We, the American people.
Well, or they have to not and fail. I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how they adapt to this. They're in a pickle. I mean, it's a problem for them. And but the fact is, the cold fact is, and they're realizing this, if they don't adapt, they cannot win.
But I do believe there is a part of the Tea Party that has sort of wider appeal. I mean, if Obama, and it's sort of spending, it's kind of out of control sort of
well, you would argue
deficit.
It shows in the success of Tim Hyman, right?
Absolutely. And nationally, there is still huge worries about that. I mean, Obama doesn't want to, nor do I think he can, have a second term that kind of fulfills all these sort of, you know, social policies, if you will, but ends up with trillions of dollars in deficits every year, so that at the end of 8 years we're sort of what, 10 trillion on his watch. I mean, he has got to get control of the sort of spending, and that comes with this fiscal compromise, that comes with that. He, you know, there's something about that everyone's got to deal with, and that will be his ultimate legacy if that is not figured out. Well,
and it traces back to Paul Tsongas. If you think about it, in the Concord Coalition, remember all that?
That is so obscure.
No,
whoa.
It's not obscure.
Well, he's sitting
whoa.
In
yeah, no,
he's sitting
it,
in Newt's chair. About he has to take us back that far.
It's about fiscal discipline. Don't forget Paul Tsongas.
That's what I say to myself every morning.
But it was definitely a touchstone for Democrats at that time, and it still is. I mean, there's still that undercurrent with Democrats who are fiscal conservatives of sort.
I don't think anybody here should write off the Tea Party or that kind of group for this reason. The American people have ADD. They do. So what you see is like 2 years ago, oh, my gosh, everybody loves the Tea Party. The Tea Party is ascendant. The Tea Party is a force to be reckoned with. It's just that we're changing our sort of collective wisdom every 2 years now. I don't know why, but we are.
Well, or you could say the media has ADD.
Well,
and the people.
The media us?
That goes without saying.
Isn't that a definition of our modern media? All right. Pete Jackson, C.R. Douglas, E.I. Sanders, Joni Balter here. A couple of quick things here before we run out of time. One is Jay Inslee and Rob McKenna. Does Rob McKenna have a chance? Now, we've talked to people who said, no way, doesn't have a chance. The King County votes have to be very much in his favor in order for him to win? Lesser the Snohomish votes. You want
to
go first?
Well, math and history are on Jay Inslee's side. He is winning, you know, by a couple percentage points now. You know, history shows that as you count ballots, certainly in the last several election cycles in Washington, there's not a ton of difference between early voters and late voters. And Rob McKenna, their hope is that something dramatic happened in those last few days, that people really, really trended to Rob, and that those ballots are going to be counted later. Now, there's some trickle of evidence that that is happening, but that needs to be a stream for this to change. And he needs Rob McKenna to have something happen that really just hasn't happened in the last several election cycles, which is that late voters dramatically differ from early voters. And that just hasn't
much higher than 40%, which is the one time was the threshold for King County.
He would have to get much higher than 40%, yeah.
All right, so what about charter schools? What did we learn about charter schools in all this?
Whoa. What we learned is that is so close that you can't really call it because, again, the dominant power of King County, even though it's nowhere near as big a number, is working against charter schools. They're at about,
50,000 votes right now separating them.
50,000. I think that one is, well, that's the same number as the governor's race.
Yeah, it's about the same.
But you have a different dynamic of King County pull there. So the King County vote is helping Jay Inslee, but it's hurting charter schools.
Yeah, it's about 2% ahead. It's about 20,000 ahead almost.
Yeah, but King County,
I mean, behind. No vote for charter schools on King County is ahead.
King County isn't, my sense is King County is not rejecting it enough to have that vote split. I think we will have a slight victory for charter schools when all the votes are counted. You know, this is sort of whack-a-mole. They have come back fourth time, and they just sort of never go away. And they've lost three times. They came back. They didn't make the mistake they made before, which is we're going to get the biggest war chest we possibly can at somewhere over $10 million. And, you know, that gets you 50 plus one, it looks like.
You know, the one last thing on that is that talking to Matt Barreto, who's been studying these things about and back to the Hispanic vote. Now, he doesn't know yet, but this is something he is conjecturing, and so he's studying the numbers, that if Jay Inslee wins, it may also be that he wins because of the Latino vote. And that maybe, I think he said it might be the first time in the nation that the Latino vote would be responsible, or first time in Washington State the Latino vote was responsible.
Well, and he's been arguing that the Latino vote has been undercounted, not just in Washington, but in Florida as well, that some of the surprising results we're seeing, especially in places like Florida, because pollsters had a hard time reaching people who were Latinos who are voting, partly language barrier in some case, and just partly polling, bad polling models.
I mean, Jay had a lot of tailwinds that helped him. I think pot helped him. I think same-sex marriage helped him. I think sort of the Obama blue wave helped him. I mean, and he needed all that. Look, he's not ahead by a ton, but it was a good year to run as a Democrat.
Any last words for America?
Oh, God. For America. The election's over. You can turn the TV set back on safely, fairly safely. And America's decided a couple things, so there.
And now the new governor will have to come up with revenues or more cuts.
They don't say that, R-word. Mm.
And the president has to come up with a compromise before we go over the fiscal cliff.
My last words for Jay Inslee, you know, and I wrote them in The Stranger this week. We've already declared the race for Jay. We're pretty confident he's going to win just based on the numbers. But my last words are that he needs to get real on taxes. There's no way to solve the problems of the state without taxes, and on a number of other issues that you can read about in The Stranger.
All right. Eli Sanders writes for The Stranger. C.R. Douglas is a political analyst at Q13 Fox. Peter Jackson is editorial page editor at the Everett Herald. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. A long week, but now it's over. Have a good week, folks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Stick around for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Western Washington University MBA program, offering flexibility while pursuing an MBA with full-time, evening, and weekend options. Information sessions in November in Bellingham, Everett, and Seattle. More at cbe.wwu.edu/MBA.
You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, where dairy farm compost goes to neighboring farms, vineyards, and orchards for growing crops like blueberries, hops, and hay. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
Hi, this.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.